Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up, how the Navajo Nation and its residents are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic and the U.S. Attorney for Arizona on immigration and other issues.
On a typical day, Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport boasts an economic impact of just more than $100 million. On a typical day, more than 1,200 aircraft carry about 120,000 passengers. But those numbers have dropped dramatically, and the future looks bleak. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me to talk about how the pandemic is impacting business at Arizona's biggest airport. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Mark.
So you listened to the city's aviation director provide an update to the city council yesterday. You describe it as grim.
Yes. Keep in mind, Director Jim Bennett has been around for the Great Recession and the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Now listen to him describe the current situation.
This will be the most severe shock to the aviation business and Sky Harbor Airport that we have ever experienced.
He shared pictures yesterday that made my jaw drop. No one's walking through the terminals or lining up the gates. The baggage carousels are at a standstill. It's really shocking to see. Bennett says passenger traffic is down 85% compared to just a couple weeks ago.
Christina, that's got to be devastating for the restaurants and retailers operating inside the airport.
It is. More than 1,000 people have lost their jobs because no one's there.
What can you tell us about changes in airline service? Any idea how many flights are being cut?
Sky Harbor shared some numbers. Southwest plans to park 20 aircraft and reduce departures from Phoenix by 50 next month. American plans to park 25 aircraft because it's flying at 30% capacity and dropping. United plans to park half of its aircraft and could reduce flights by 50% in Phoenix. And as you know, Mark, this is a global crisis, and Bennett explained the impact on international service.
We've lost all of our flights to London. The flights that were supposed to start to Frankfurt, Germany in April have been postponed indefinitely. And all of our Canadian service will be suspended as of March the 28th.
He says Sky Harbor will probably keep one or two flights to Mexico for now, but he expects they'll be suspended in the future. And he expects more reductions to flights in April and possibly into May.
Christina, there's a lot of uncertainty as to how bad things will get and how long they'll last. So does the airport have any idea when things might begin to return to normal?
Well, based on current modeling, Sky Harbor forecasts it will be sometime in late 2022 or maybe 2023. When passenger levels return to what they saw last year.
And that was a record year for them, right? A little more than 46 million passengers?
Yes, and before the outbreak, they were thinking they could see another record this year.
Wow. So Sky Harbor is essentially the landlord for the airlines and other businesses that operate there. What's the airport doing to help its tenants?
Sky Harbor is working with airlines to defer their rent for the next 3 months and considering ways to help restaurants and retail shops pay less rent.
What about the federal government? The $2 trillion emergency bill does have a section devoted to aviation.
Bennett said the Senate version of the bill focused on airlines and had no provisions for restaurants and retailers that operated airports. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're out of luck. They may be eligible for grants or loans offered to small businesses. Phoenix's Economic Development Department is working on an explainer video to help business owners navigate the federal process. That video should be on the city's website later today.
So, Christina, there's also a lot of construction taking place at Sky Harbor. They're tearing down Terminal 2, modernizing Terminal 3, and expanding the SkyTrain. What will happen to those projects?
They should continue. Bennett says the projects, which support about 3,000 construction jobs, are either funded by bonds or federal grants, and that money cannot be used for other reasons. Plus, he says the projects will be needed when the downturn ends in late 2022 or 2023.
All right, that is KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, thank you.
You're welcome.
The so-called Right to Try movement began as an effort to speed up the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's drug approval process. It's based on the idea that terminally ill patients should be able to use experimental treatments or therapies that have completed some testing, but that have not yet received FDA approval. And now supporters are urging officials to remove regulatory barriers in the age of COVID-19. I spoke with Naomi Lopez earlier. She's director of healthcare policy at the Goldwater Institute, which has long led the charge on Right to Try. And I started by asking her to explain Right to Try and how it may fit into the current situation with COVID-19.
Right to Try is about getting the right treatment to the right patient at the right time. And the Right to Try movement really did help move that effort forward by shining a bright light on just how long it takes to get treatments through the FDA approval process. We all want to know that our treatments are safe and effective, but in some cases, like today in particular, patients just don't have time to wait years for something to get the final FDA green light. And that's why I think you're seeing so much focus on treatments that are now in the pipeline. There's far more public awareness that there might be treatments that might work and that patients, in some cases, can access them.
Now, there was criticism of the Right to Try effort that what it was doing potentially is giving people an opportunity to maybe try drugs that were not completely through the pipeline yet. But there were some people who were concerned that, well, there were reasons they weren't through the pipeline yet.
Well, the Right to Try works in tandem with the FDA approval process, and treatments have to be prescribed by a provider, and the manufacturer has to be willing and able to make that treatment available. And there are also provisions for informed consent. So obviously, there are safety concerns anytime someone is using an investigational treatment, but that's true inside a clinical trial as well as outside. So there really are a lot of protections for the patients in Right to Try as well as other avenues that use the FDA. But the bottom line is that whenever your life hangs in the balance, you shouldn't have to beg the federal government for permission to try to save your life. And that's what the Right to Try does.
As people are concerned about what happened in China, what happened in Italy, obviously, and as we expand the reach here in the U.S., a Right to Try-like effort, would it be slightly different because we're talking about tens of millions of people who potentially would want to try something as opposed to someone who might have a rare illness, for example?
But the reason that this is so important at this particular time, whether you're talking about a rare disease or you're talking about the coronavirus, is that there are currently no FDA-approved vaccines or treatments for COVID-19. And whenever you are out of options, whenever you perhaps don't qualify for a clinical trial, you've exhausted all of the approved treatments, and your life hangs in the balance, that's the point in time when Right to Try becomes so incredibly important. And of course, we know that there are safety concerns and risks with any treatment, I mean, even acetaminophen. But if you have the information about what the risks are and your physician thinks that it is an appropriate treatment for you and they're willing to prescribe it, and the manufacturer is able to and willing to make it available, then that decision is based on the available treatments and the risk to the patient. And so it is really important to think about this in the context of what options remain. You know, obviously, if there were 18 FDA-approved treatments for COVID-19, we wouldn't need to have this conversation, you know, but we're not there. We are a long way from being there and from having it under control and having any treatments for symptoms or a vaccine against it. And so that's why we're having this important conversation. When patients are facing a life-threatening or terminal illness, whether it be coronavirus or something that we know more about, it really does become incredibly important that the available options aren't limited by only the FDA giving it a final green light.
What are you watching for next in terms of seeing what the next steps are, not necessarily in developing vaccines, but finding alternative treatments potentially to deal with COVID-19?
Well, a lot of pharmaceuticals right now are scouring their libraries of treatments, both for off-label use, but also for treatments that were abandoned in the clinical trial process. It's really important to know that there are so many treatments that aren't abandoned in the clinical trial process because they're ineffective. In fact, many are abandoned because of the financial obstacles to getting something through the clinical trial process. It's incredibly expensive, and the risk reward sometimes is just not going to be something that fits within a company's ability to see it to the finish line. And so there are a lot of those treatments out there. There is a treatment called remdesivir that has been provided in the hospital setting already in the United States. It was originally developed to treat Ebola and was abandoned because there were more effective treatments. It looks like it's a promising treatment in this particular case. We won't know for sure whether it is in fact effective, but it was in phase three, which is the last phase before it can get a final FDA green light. And so that is actually being used in the hospital setting right now. I'm watching for not only the new treatments that are coming on that are in the clinical trial process, but also the older treatments that were already in the trial process, but were abandoned at some point because of the obstacles that they faced to getting it to completing the clinical trials due to cost in most cases.
Do you have any concerns that as people are more worried about the spread and the impact of COVID-19, that caution will be put aside and we'll keep pushing and pushing to find things? Or do you feel, based on what you said about what researchers are doing, what pharmaceutical companies are doing, do you think there is at least enough care being taken that as we move forward, it's not just about getting something fast, even though many people are worried?
There's a critical balance here. And I think that in most cases, when we're talking about something where there are no options that are FDA approved, there is a different risk calculus that you've got to take. I mean, obviously, if someone has a headache, you don't want to start with something that's investigational when we have so many products, you know, that are in a physician's arsenal and toolkit. But when you're talking about something where there aren't any other options, I think that we really are willing and should be willing to take on more risk in that process. And obviously you have to have informed consent. You can't just provide it without informing the patient. But I do think that in many cases, there's a much greater willingness to have more risk with the possibility that you might have something that works.
Naomi Lopez is Director of Healthcare Policy at the Goldwater Institute. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our Women of the West series continues. Today we'll hear about an education leader who lived through the desegregation of Arizona schools and became a beloved member of the Phoenix community.
You know, Miss Betty really didn't focus a lot on her own personal hardships. What she focused on is what she could do for other people.
We'll hear more about Betty Fairfax later this hour on the show.
But first, lawmakers are moving forward with an emergency relief bill that could in part help save small local businesses from devastation in the wake of the coronavirus. The bill includes a nearly $350 billion loan program to cover various monthly expenses like payroll and retroactive assistance for people who have already lost their jobs. But is it enough now and for when this crisis has passed? Charlene Badman is the James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of F&B in Scottsdale, and she's been calling on local restaurateurs like her to show Congress just how much relief they really need. Our co-host Lauren Gilger caught up with her this week and started by talking about how difficult it's been for her this week as she and her business partner chose to shut down.
You know, we did try to stay open for a bit. We're usually closed on Mondays, so we opened on Tuesday, did service Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, even Friday, did 100 takeout orders. But every day, just the fact that we were asking, staff to still come in, and it was just a few. There were four or five out of our 25 people that we have that work with us, and it just was really conflicting and really difficult. And yeah, I was literally having nightmares about it. And, you know, everybody in this business has to make a decision. And, you know, some people had decided to close right away and some people are still doing takeout. And, you know, it was a decision just for myself and for Pavli and our business that we just couldn't continue on. We didn't want to risk our staff and ourselves. We were there all of these days, and it just didn't feel like it was the right thing to do.
Did you have to lay off everybody involved, or are you trying to keep them on?
No, we've laid off our entire staff. So, you know, 25 plus myself and Pavli. I mean, that's how we make a living as well.
Wow. How did that feel? I mean, this is something you've built for so long and worked so hard to do and gotten so much recognition for. What was this like?
it feels horrible to have to lay off your staff and to have to close your restaurant in the peak. It's March and everybody knows in Arizona that's the busiest. It's our busiest month. It's always been our busiest month. You know, I've been in this business for a really long time, and March is where you make all your money. You make all your money basically February, March, and April in order to get through the summer, which are really not just June, July, and August. It's September, part of October, before people come back. And to have to do that and also to have to to do that, to have to close down our place when we're just on such a high. I won the James Beard Award last year. Then we've just been nominated for Best Wine Program. So it's just like this high that we have. We just turned 10, all of these things. And then just to have to be like, turn the key and shut the lights off is devastating.
What did you hear from your employees? Were they supportive of your decision?
They are. I mean, they're upset too. I've had employees that have worked for us for several years, some of them 7 and 8 years, and others 4 or 5 years, very dedicated employees. And they understood, and they are just very supportive. Some of them, we're all staying in touch somehow. And we're all just kind of keeping it together and trying to do the best we can. We made sure that we paid them all out. We, during that period of time that we were open, the few days for takeout, all of the tips were dispersed amongst everybody, from the dishwashers, prep cooks, cooks, servers. Everybody was able to get something. We literally emptied out the walk-in and turned our little bar area into like a little, we should have taken a picture, but it kind of just looked like a little bodega back to what it was originally, and let them bring bags. And we had them come in 10 minutes at a time, staggered times for each person to come in and just grab as much food as they possibly could.
Wow.
And again, just staying in touch with them. We just reached our goal of trying to give the staff each $1,000. And I have to say that our community is amazing. If it's not Trula Seafood or Nelson's or Bob McClendon or Steadfast Farms, Dave the Eggman, I mentioned all these people, mm-hmm. even Nyman Ranch reached out and they're like, what can we do for your staff? Can we give your staff some food? And that's really just amazing because a couple of them have said, if I don't have to buy groceries, I can make it for a month. I don't know how long this will last. And to have to look at them and tell them that I don't know is even more heartbreaking.
Yeah. So tell me about the Independent Restaurant Coalition. How did this kick off, and what is it that you're asking our lawmakers for?
Well, I actually received a text from a couple of chefs in South Carolina that I had actually never met. And they said, unfortunately, and I got this text at 5 o'clock in the morning last Thursday, saying, can you please get on this call at 7 o'clock in the morning? And I was like, yeah, I'll do whatever we have to do to get this, ball rolling. And there were about 70 chefs from all over the country, not in chefs and restaurateurs, owners really at the end of the day. And we were just all on the phone kind of trying to figure out how we could put together a group and really get together and all on the same page as to what we were going to have to, ask for, what our ask was going to be, instead of having a lot of different little asks, to really unify and come together.
Okay, so the Senate did pass an aid package yesterday, which mm-hmm. the House is expected to approve tomorrow, and then the president has said he'll sign it. Is there enough in that package for small businesses, for restaurants like yours?
Well, the Beard Foundation has also been working with the Independent Restaurant Coalition. They're working together in order to make sure that we are being informed, too, of like what the breakdown is, how it looks to help us. And there are a lot of pieces, especially, if you have a under 500 employees, and that would definitely be the independent restaurants. And again, I have 25. So what they'll be able to help us with and be able to have provisions to specifically help us with loans and also expanding the loan forgiveness. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of parts to it that would be specific for the independent restaurateur. And this is, restaurants were the only industry that this specific treatment was put into by the stimulus. So that's encouraging that they were listening to us and they were recognizing that, underneath the federal government, restaurants are the largest employer in the United States. And there was a reason why we were, banging on the doors asking for some help because there's just so many of us that need it.
Is it enough?
Well, that remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. I'm very concerned that when we all do get back to work, and this is specifically for Arizona, that we will be possibly in our worst time of the year. And that because we have not been able to save, and even though you have a loan coming, being able to get a loan or things like that, or you're being able to defer your rent, we'll be back open during the worst time of the year, where something like that, having to repay things, will not be feasible. I'm afraid that that's really when we're going to see the worst of it financially as far as restaurants go.
Yeah. Do you think without this kind of support, you would be able to reopen?
Without it? Absolutely not. If we don't have the support, we won't be able to reopen. I can say that right now. We have a little bit of savings, but it's going to go very quickly. I need to make sure that our health insurance is still paid. They're not deferring that. Mm-hmm. They're still going to be charging everybody the health insurance. And we have almost half our staff has health insurance to the restaurant. And I have to make sure that gets taken care of somehow. And we're still going to have bills that have to be paid.
Charlene, do you see any silver lining in this? I mean, is there some hope that you have that this will build a stronger food and restaurant community here in the Valley?
If you want to see, it's hard to say a silver lining at this right now while we're in the bottom. But restaurant communities always are like that. You're already seeing it with the people I've just mentioned that are willing to help us out, that don't have really anything at all. I mean, the fact that farmers are willing to give, I'm going to go meet a farmer that just pulled a bunch of lettuces from his field, and he's going to meet me to drop it off to give to my staff too, because he just wants to help out. And these are people that don't know how much money they're going to be making because they rely on us, and we're not making any at all either. It's just this thing. But I feel these are people that the restaurant community is just a group that doesn't give up and does everything they possibly can to have everybody come together. And I just hope, you know, when we do get through this, that we just have this like one big happy family meal, and everybody just makes a pot of something that makes them really happy, and we all get to share. And that's, I don't know, that can be my crazy idea, but that's what I've been talking about the last couple of weeks, that it just sounds to me like a relief to come together and eat as a group and really appreciate one another. And I hope that it's sooner than later.
All right. Charlene Badman is the chef and co-owner of F&B in Scottsdale.
A certain number of bad actors emerges when people are on edge and uncertainty is in the air. That is already the case in relation to coronavirus, as some supposed businesses have popped up with the sole purpose of defrauding the public. That has led Arizona's U.S. Attorney's Office to appoint Assistant U.S. Attorney Tim Knapp as COVID-19 fraud coordinator. Knapp says the scams so far are nothing new.
You know, we've seen a lot of these types of frauds before. I've been a prosecutor for 13 years. Doing a mix of things, but lots of it white collar crime. And the things that we're seeing already and anticipating that we're going to see are consistent with what we've seen in other types of scams, you know, fake products, email scams, and malicious websites.
And the intensity of the scams may be even greater because of the health related implications.
There's going to be a lot of email solicitations from people claiming that they have, you know, miracle cures, testing kits. A lot of times those are going to be fraudulent claims. I mean, we just got to be careful and make sure that you're reaching out to your healthcare providers and doing what common sense dictates rather than, you know, sort of operating out of panic and following up on suspicious emails.
That's the U.S. Attorney's Office COVID-19 Fraud Coordinator Jim Knapp. Recently, I spoke with Knapp's boss, U.S. Attorney Michael Bailey, for a broader conversation. Bailey was appointed by President Donald Trump last February and confirmed by the U.S. Senate in May, ending a two-year period without a permanent U.S. attorney in the state at the start of Trump's term. Since his confirmation, Bailey's office notably has lost its case against No More Deaths volunteer Scott Warren, but it's also successfully prosecuted members of a Phoenix-based drug ring that used the dark web to peddle substances like heroin, as well as a former Border Patrol agent who assisted drug traffickers. I sat down with Bailey to get his take on what his nearly 1 year in the job has been like, and I started by asking him to compare it to the work he'd done in Arizona's Attorney General's office.
It's very much different than my day-to-day job was at the Attorney General's office, where I was essentially running or managing an office that was almost three times the size of the U.S. Attorney's office, with mostly civil components and a small criminal component consisting of investigations and prosecutors. But I've long been interested in criminal justice policy and taking certain directions with the actual prosecution of cases, and have thoughts on how best to do that fairly and equitably. And obviously, I'm thrilled to have had the opportunity to be the U.S. attorney for a period of time.
So it's been not quite a year, but almost a year or so. Can you compare expectations to reality for you?
Sure. I had many expectations that I think have probably been met pretty straight on with respect to managing people. The new thing to me is the federal system, and most of my practice and work has been in the state system before. So the federal system is new, and it does have some idiosyncrasies that it's taken a while to get to used to. It's a big bureaucracy, that's for sure. That was one of the earliest things I learned with respect to where do we go for answers, how many people do we have to talk to, and that kind of thing. Another aspect is learning some of the areas of law that are federal specific and that we didn't deal with in the state.
Mm-hmm. How much collaboration from the movies now? We see that, well, I've got jurisdiction, I've got jurisdiction. How much do you as a federal official now work with the state, and did your experience with the state make that a little bit easier transition?
The federal law enforcement agencies, such as the FBI and Homeland Security Investigations, DEA, ATF, and others, as well as our office, are in many common joint efforts with various state agencies, including the Attorney General's office in the counties and the sheriffs in the cities. In some sense, we all have individual lanes when it comes to prosecute, and so typically something that the federal agencies are investigating, we're going to ultimately prosecute, and something that the state and local law enforcement is investigating, they're going to prosecute. That said, there is some overlap, and we have a history, I think, long before I was in this office, of working closely with the state and local agencies to take cases where there's concurrent jurisdiction in an arena where they make the most sense to go.
U.S. attorney serves at the pleasure of the president. That's often a phrase we hear. Can you let us in a little bit? How often do you hear from the DOJ, and how often is what you're prioritizing? Do they have to sort of work in step?
The Department of Justice distributes to all the U.S. attorneys a broad set of principles. Some of the things that this Department of Justice is focusing on include, most recently presented a firearms effort called Project Guardian. Our effort here in Arizona is especially focused on southbound firearms traffic, and a lot of firearm smuggling is going on from the U.S. into Mexico, and these firearms simply come back to hurt us, number one, because the cartels are so well armed now that they can create and distribute drugs in a mind-boggling volume, and secondly, of course, they can be used against our own law enforcement officers, in which Arizona is familiar with the history of that. Other areas that the Department of Justice is focusing on, of course, immigration itself. It's a priority for the department to do full immigration enforcement. Elder fraud and abuse is a third big issue that we're dealing with. And it's clear to us, even though there are some priorities, that we have a broad range of federal jurisdiction and need to enforce the law, the criminal law, anywhere people are victimized.
One case I did want to ask you about was the Scott Warren case that relates somewhat to immigration enforcement. Was that a situation where you were both following the philosophy of what you believe and also the administration?
Comment briefly on the Warren case.
Sure.
I don't know exactly when the Warren case was brought. It was before my time, but certainly during an era when immigration enforcement was a priority. And I quickly learned a lesson that I've since learned that every U.S. attorney before me has learned, which is there is a large and well-spoken activist community that doesn't appreciate any border enforcement, frankly. And the Warren case kind of fell into that neighborhood. And in reviewing the Warren case, I've had to make some assessments on my own as to where we want to go as an office. And again, the Department of Justice guidance is much more general on all of these issues, so that we know we want to come in with the goal of enforcing immigration vigorously. And we are doing that, and we do that essentially in three ways. We prosecute those people who are reentering the country after being deported. That's a federal felony. We prosecuted 11,000 plus of those cases last year, and we just started, incidentally, this year, tracking some of the criminal history of our reentry cases and have found that a surprising number of those reentering after deportation have a state and local criminal history. I want to make one thing clear, that there is a vast operation of administrative immigration and civil immigration process. The only thing I can comment on with respect to immigration enforcement is the criminal process, which is far from everybody that ICE might deal with, for example. But in my view, the Warren case is represented a subset of our human smuggling work, where one of the open borders groups might want to help immigrants make it along the way on their journey with avoiding detection by the Border Patrol. They call that humanitarian aid. I call humanitarian aid giving water to the thirsty, and if somebody's starving, giving them something to eat. And certainly that's not something that we have the resources or time to prosecute, true humanitarian aid like that. But when you're falsely calling what is essentially harboring humanitarian aid, then it falls under the harboring statute and it's fair game for prosecution. And when we confront that, we absolutely have a responsibility to prosecute it. Most of our smuggling work, harboring prosecution, involves criminal organizations where immigrants have paid them to get them into the country.
That is Michael Bailey. He is U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona. Good to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. A Phoenix-based biotech firm is hoping to start human clinical trials to test whether an engineered virus can kill off cancer cells while not hurting healthy ones. OncoMix was formed with that goal in mind and recently finalized a licensing deal with ASU's Tech Transfer Organization. To talk more about the science behind this, I spoke recently with Grant McFadden. He's a professor at ASU and director of the Biodesign Institute Center for Immunotherapy, Vaccines, and Virotherapy. And I asked him to tell me about this virus he's been able to turn into something that seems like it can actually benefit people.
Yeah, a lot of people are worried about viruses. Even the word scares many people. But the truth is, there are viruses all over the planet. There's an amazing amount of virus material everywhere. And the majority of them don't cause disease. It's the oddball virus that causes disease. So I'm studying a virus that is in nature trapped in rabbits. And for years, I studied it as a rabbit pathogen. It causes a disease that rabbit people know. It's called myxomatosis, and the virus is called myxoma. So I was studying this virus for many years just to study why it was a rabbit pathogen. And we discovered by accident that the virus also attacks human cancer cells.
How did you find that out?
It was a little bit by accident. It happened over time. We were working with it in the lab. And in our laboratory, we have many different kinds of cells in addition to rabbit cells. And we were doing other experiments for a different purpose. And when we put this virus on human cancer cells, we found it treated them the same way it does rabbit cells. It finds them, infects them, and kills them.
So this kind of seems like it could potentially be the mythical cure for cancer. I mean, is that overstating it?
Yes, it's overstating it a little bit. In the old days, people were thinking of the term magic bullet for viruses that infect only cancers. But the reality is many viruses like this have been in clinical trial. And what we find in patients is that the virus grows for a while, but then vanishes. The immune system is able to get rid of most viruses of this category. The trick is to have the virus activate the immune system when it's in a tumor bed to now take over and eliminate the cancer via the actions of the immune system.
So it sounds like what you're saying is the virus would actually act as almost like an agent of the immune system. The virus is there. It triggers, hey, immune system, I'm here. And in turn, the immune system would then come and get rid of the virus and the cancer cells at the same time?
Yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, the trick is to try and kill cancer cells in a new way that wakes up the immune system. because many cancers are actually very good at turning the immune system off. And there's a class of drugs called immunotherapeutics or immune checkpoint inhibitors that are in fact designed to activate the immune system and to allow it to attack the cancer. And so viruses can work in very close conjunction or in synergy with immune checkpoint inhibitors.
This sounds like one of those things that, as with so many things with cancer, that would be of most benefit if the cancer is caught early enough and there are fewer cells, the tumor itself is smaller. Is that fair?
That's fair to say. And also when the immune system is in the best shape possible. So often when people are treated for cancer, let's say chemotherapy, it can compromise their immune systems. And we now know that the immune system is the thing we want for virotherapy, for example, in order to completely clear a cancer.
Are there particular types of cancers that this has so far shown to be more helpful in fighting?
So the majority of cancers that we've tested in the lab are very responsive to incredibly responsive to the virus. So we haven't found any restriction in the lab yet, but the story could be different once we're in cancer patients.
Given all the variables that go along with cancer, is it harder to maybe study this particular disease than some others?
So remember that cancer is not one disease. There are hundreds of diseases that we all call cancer, and they're quite different from each other. They share some similarities, but they're quite different. And so drugs tend to work for some and not others. Immunotherapeutics tend to work for some and not others. And so it is a little bit of learning how to treat. This is the practice of oncology, is learning what works against specific cancers. And no one will have a magic bullet that will treat every cancer. But every tool that we get in the toolkit is another step down the road.
So you see this then as a potential treatment, not the potential treatment.
Correct. I see this working in conjunction with other therapeutics, in particular immunotherapy.
What is it about this particular virus that goes after the bad cells and not the good ones?
So it's kind of interesting. The field of oncolytic virotherapy, which is the field of using live viruses to treat cancer, started with the idea that a virus had to infect and kill every cancer cell. We now know that's wrong. What the virus has to do is wake up the immune system. It doesn't have to kill every cancer cell. But why the virus grows better in some cancer cells differs from virus to virus. But the fundamental principle is that cancer cells themselves have an Achilles heel. All cancer cells, as part and parcel of becoming cancerous, develop susceptibilities to infection. They lose their ability to protect themselves from infection by many viruses. And so what the field is doing is exploiting this natural Achilles heel of cancer cells.
And are you able to, you mentioned engineering the virus, are you able to tweak it if necessary to a patient's particular situation, their DNA, the type of cancer cells that they have in their bodies?
Yeah, in short, that is what we do in the lab, is we genetically engineer the virus to make it a better killer of cancer cells or a better stimulator of the immune system. And part of our job is to figure out what genetic engineering tricks to use to make it do that better.
Are there other diseases for which this has or could also have benefit?
So remember, viruses are used to treat a whole variety of diseases. They were used for gene therapy. And in fact, the majority of our live vaccines are based on viruses. So there's a long history of exploiting viruses for human health.
Are there other people doing this kind of research as well?
Yes. There are a number of viruses that are in differing stages of clinical development. One of them has actually been approved by the FDA, and it is used in the clinic for metastatic melanoma. And it is in trials right now in combination with immunotherapies. And the scientific community is kind of anxiously awaiting the results of those combined trials.
So would that and what you're working on, would those in theory work in conjunction with each other, or some might be more appropriate for certain patients than others?
Yeah, some would likely be more appropriate for some patients and not others. But yes, our thoughts are that this virus will work very well with a number of immunotherapies.
All right, that is Grant McFadden, the director of the Biodesign Institute Center for Immunotherapy, Vaccines, and Virotherapies, also a professor at ASU. Grant, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Arizona boasts of many women who have made history both here and on the national stage. It's easy to name the Sandra Day O'Connors and Rose Moffords, but what about those who are lesser known? Last year, we introduced you to five women who made a difference in their communities. This year, for Women's History Month, we're introducing you to more Arizona women who helped shape their communities and the state's history. Today, we're going to hear about Betty Fairfax. Her name might sound familiar since it's on a high school in the Phoenix Union High School District. She was a longtime educator, spending time both in the classroom and as a counselor. I recently sat down to talk about Betty Fairfax with Akwia Duku Anoche, who is, among other things, the Associate Director of ASU School of Humanities, Arts, and Cultural Studies. And I started our conversation by asking how she got to know Betty Fairfax.
I have been teaching at Arizona State University for 20 years now. When I first arrived in Arizona, I came from places that were very much, if not dominated, very much engaged with African Americans all of my life. Then I came to Arizona, and I found very little of that, at least initially. And so as an oral historian, and as a person who is just very inquisitive and had moved to a new space, I wanted to learn more about the African American presence. And Miss Betty Fairfax was one of the first people that I happened to meet, fortunately.
What was your first impression of her?
I was so impressed. I was wowed. First of all, she was a beautiful woman. But her spirit was just so loud and so outspoken and so ready to always take care of and help others. So I was immediately attracted to her.
When you talk about the desire to help others, I mean, that was kind of her career, right? She was in education. She was a school counselor. Mm-hmm. How did her upbringing prepare her for that kind of career?
Well, interestingly enough, and you probably know that Betty Fairfax is the sister to Jean Fairfax. They were the dynamic duo. And they got it from their parents. In fact, both their mother and their father graduated from University of Kansas at the turn of the 20th century.
Wow.
And so were very influential in their lives. And in particular, Miss Betty's mother reinforced with her how important it was to give back to those who didn't have everything that they themselves possessed.
What was Phoenix education like at the time that Betty Fairfax came here and started working here?
Mm-hmm. Miss Betty came here, I think, at the end of the 50s. Everything was very segregated. I've interviewed a number of other people who were natives of Arizona, particularly of Phoenix, and they always mentioned that they couldn't live past South Jefferson. She taught at Carver High School, and as a matter of fact, they had a tennis team, and she was the physical ed teacher, and she was also the coach for the tennis team. And she tells the story about one time that the team was going to another city in Arizona, and she was told that she shouldn't come because there was no place for her to stay. So the team, of course, decided they didn't want to go after that. But instead, she insisted that they do go, and in fact, they won. But that was just the beginning of her encouraging and supporting others, even if she couldn't be the beneficiary directly.
Did she talk about the challenges of being African-American and an African-American woman in this city doing the kind of job that she did at that time?
You know, Miss Betty really didn't focus a lot on her own personal hardships. What she focused on is what she could do for other people.
So as her career progressed, mm-hmm. the district that she worked for was integrated. Mm-hmm. She stayed on and became a school counselor. What was the reaction of white families mm-hmm. for their kids to have an African-American school counselor?
Mm-hmm. Well, initially, as I said, she was teaching at Dunbar, but she was recruited to become a counselor at Central High School. And at that time, there was big protest because most parents and even her fellow teachers didn't want her there didn't think that she had anything to offer their students. And there were a number of protests that she did report about. Fortunately, over the years, she won everyone over. In fact, she was the one who initiated home visits in Phoenix. And she would go to the homes, and her intent was to be there not just for the children, but also for the parents, and to get them to feel comfortable about the relationship that they needed to design with the schools. And so by the time Miss Betty was ready to retire, it really took her 2 or 3 years to retire because none of the teachers and none of the parents wanted her to retire. They begged her to stay on. And so literally she was either 92 or 93 before they finally said, okay, Miss Betty, you can go.
That's quite a reversal from not wanting her there to not wanting her not to be there.
Absolutely, absolutely. She was an incredible woman. I had an opportunity to work with her on a number of occasions. And so when I asked her whether I could do an oral history with her, she was very, very resistant. She says, no, I don't need anybody messing up my life or telling it the way it wasn't. But I promised her that I would use her words and I wouldn't misrepresent hers. But the only way that she agreed for me to do the interviews with her was I had to go dancing with her.
How was that?
Oh, man, it was incredible. She, again, as I said, she must have been 92 or 93 at the time. She was walking with a cane. And very stately woman, but walking with a cane. We went to the rhythm room, and her favorite band was playing, and she insisted that I get up and dance with her. Well, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, dance with you? You can barely walk. And so she barely walked out to the dance floor, literally threw the cane to the side and just cut a rug. I could not believe it. It was one of the best times I can ever remember having. But she wouldn't interview with me until I promised to go dancing with her.
Okwia Duku Anoche is Associate Director of the School of Humanities, Arts, and Cultural Studies at ASU.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Now it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Our directives have been in guidance with the CDC, the NIH, and the Arizona Department of Health Services, and they're going to continue to be that way. They're not going to be political decisions, and they're not going to be guesses. And that's how we're going to continue to operate, and that's how I've operated to date.
We believe that the peak of our illnesses will start mid to end of April, with peak hospitalizations in May. This is all based on computers and very smart people, but that's what we are trying to get ahead of.
Cities are concerned about cleaning bathrooms, you know, all the details that we have to think about in terms of logistics to keep it clean for our community. The bathrooms in parks, playground equipment for children.
It's great to see us coming together as Democrats, as Republicans, but most importantly, as Arizonans, to get this bipartisan compromise out of the door and into the hands of the people who it really needs to help, which is the hardworking Arizonans all across the state.
And with us to talk about the latest coronavirus-related policies, the legislature passing a budget, and more are Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic and Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Unfortunately, because of the coronavirus, they are joining us remotely. Gentlemen, how are you?
Great.
Good.
How about you?
Good. You guys are at least 6 feet apart, I hope.
Yes.
I think 6 miles.
Probably more than that.
Yes, 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 yes. Chad, let me start off with you. This is a political segment. We're going to focus on the politics of this. How do you think Governor Ducey has performed so far?
I guess if I was grading him, I'd probably give him a C right now. I think that he's done some good things, but he also hasn't done enough in some ways. We've seen some slow reaction here in the state, I think, compared to other places. We've seen many of the mayors take the lead early on putting some of these restrictions in place that we all know now are necessary. We saw some mayors here in the Valley, Phoenix Mayor Kay Gallego, Tolleson Mayor Anna Tovar, Mayor Cora Evans up in Flagstaff. They all took the early lead on putting some of these restrictions in place. And then the governor kind of followed after that. So he's been a little slow in reacting in some ways. But on the flip side of that, I will give him credit for some of the executive orders he's done this week. He's protecting renters. He's doing some things out there proactively to try to offset some of the economic losses that we're going to suffer, I think, or face here. So I give him some credit for that as well.
Marcus, go ahead.
You know, well, first of all, I want to tell you I miss you guys. It's a lot different not being in the studio in person with you and give everybody my best. But two, you know, I think he's done a fantastic job. People need to realize that this is it's a crisis. It's one of the worst crises we've been through. As a leader, it is challenging, and it is it tests every moment of your being. That being said, even at this point, you know, Governor Cuomo is saying, you know, if I had to do it over again, I'm not too sure I would have gone to the great lengths that I did. I might have done some things differently, especially with shutting down businesses, because the economic disaster that we are going to have to recover from is devastating, the likes of which he's never seen. So I think that the governor's taking things like that into account at the same time. He wants everybody to be safe. He wants them to be healthy. And at the same time, not destroy an entire state economy in the mix. And that is a difficult balancing act.
Well, balancing act is exactly the phrase I was thinking of, Chad, because this is a situation where this governor tends to be, for the most part, tends to be practical. Some critics would say he's a reactor when it comes to this. When it comes to waiting until a county has gotten a case, that seems to have thrown a lot of people off, especially Senator Sinema, who's been very critical of him.
Yeah, and I think that's another area of concern in terms of how the governor's handled this. We know that this virus doesn't care about county lines or state lines or any type of line on a map. It's going to spread based on human contact. And if it hasn't popped up in a county yet, in all likelihood, it's going to pop up in a county. So you really should be putting these restrictions in place across the board. If you're going to do it, put it across the board. That's how you slow the spread. That's how you flatten the curve, as everybody's talking about these days. So that's another area of concern, and I'm not sure why the governor chose to do this kind of piecemeal approach as these cases popped up around the state. And we'll see in the long run whether or not it works. You know, thankfully for Arizona, the one thing we have going for us, you know, outside of Phoenix and Tucson, we don't have many high-density areas. That's a good thing, obviously, when it comes to this virus situation we're in. So hopefully that'll slow the spread. And I think we'll know, we're seeing and hearing from experts that we'll probably know something in the next several weeks what our peak is going to look like.
Chad, let me stick with you for just one sec to ask you about what Marcus said about Governor Cuomo in New York. There are some who are saying, well, let's attack this as much as we can because we've seen what the effects can be in places like China and Italy. How difficult is that for a governor? You almost ran for governor. So how difficult would that have been for someone to make a decision like that, knowing that, you know, your economy is going to go in the tank, but you also, you need to protect lives. You have to.
Yeah. I mean, to Marcus's point, this is unprecedented. This is something none of us have seen before, something hopefully none of us will see again in our lifetimes. And I feel for any governor out there. I want to stress that this is not a political issue at the end of the day. This is a human issue and an economic issue, as Marcus pointed out. And it's a fine balancing act. I don't know what the future holds for not just Arizona, but this country, economically speaking. Nothing like this has happened in generations. And maybe nothing like this happened before when it comes to shutting down an entire economy for a while. And I think that's been a concern of mine and many others from day one, not with Governor Ducey, not with Governor Cuomo, but with really the Trump administration. Hasn't really seemed to be a proactive plan about how to deal with this. It's been reactive from day one. I think most of us will agree that the Trump administration kind of just, pushed this aside at the beginning and didn't really take it seriously. And now we're paying the price for that. And I still don't see a plan to where we pivot. There doesn't seem to be any pivot point in any planning at any level of government yet as to how we're going to turn that corner and manage this virus, because it's here to stay. This virus isn't going away, while also letting us experience economic growth, because we have to do that at some point. We cannot shut down our economy in perpetuity. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, whatever you may be. I think everyone agrees with that. At some point, we have to figure out how to start the economy back up. And the longer we wait, the harder it's going to be.
So, Marcus, how much harder does that make for a Governor Ducey, for example, to have the Trump administration seemingly, at least publicly, pretty inconsistent?
Oh, it's hard for every leader. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, I look at the world sort of map on this, and I understand people saying that the governor's being reactive. But the fact of the matter is, I think when you look at the world stage, most every leader has been reactive because we're dealing with something we have never dealt with before. As we can see, one of the most challenging things we've ever had to deal with. I've been watching obviously a lot of movies, and for your listeners that watched Apollo 13, you'll remember Gene Kranz is overhearing a couple people talk about this could be NASA's greatest disaster, and he returns fire and says, "With all due respect, I think this might be our greatest moment." And I think that is, I think we need to keep that in mind, that this very well could be for Arizona, for the country, for the world, one of our greatest moments as we're watching these businesses quickly transform. I mean, you've got Ford Motor Company and a vacuum cleaner company, Dyson, going into the ventilator business virtually overnight, putting their best engineers to work. We're watching every brewery in town now making hand sanitizer. God love them. So there's all these great stories that are going on. Yeah, we absolutely need certainty. Chad is absolutely right. That is the best medicine for all Arizonans right now, is just some certainty of how long we're going to be locked down. When can we get back to business? But keep in mind, we're also having to deal with sort of the daily emergencies that governors have to deal with while looking at the bigger emergency. So there's a lot on the plate. There's no doubt about it. But I think eventually we can all get there.
It's the NewsCap here on KGAZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Marcus Dellartino and Chad Campbell. Marcus, let me stick with you on how some of the mayors, and Chad referenced a couple of them earlier, how they feel about what the governor's been doing. Does it put them in a tough position? We've often talked about the state versus city fight around here. Should cities be able to sort of take their own reins, especially if the governor is not doing what they want, or should there be more collaboration? How realistic is all that?
I don't think there's any doubt there should be more collaboration. I mean, this is a state, to Chad's point, this is a statewide issue. This isn't a Flagstaff issue. It's not a Tucson issue. And so that being said, you know, direction and leadership and the regulations have to come from the governor or from the state of Arizona. I don't care how you want to describe it, but it needs to be done in statewide context. There needs to be consistency throughout the state, so that people know the rules and regulations apply to Navajo County just as well as they do to Maricopa County, especially for, you know, what if the regulations for truck drivers were different in between the counties or the cities right now? That uncertainty is not something that we need right now. We need more certainty, not less.
Chad, let me ask you one question when it comes to some of the mayors you've mentioned. You know, we're not really thinking about that in this moment necessarily, but how closely are you watching to see whether these are future stars of Arizona politics as far as how they're handling this?
Well, you know, unfortunately, sometimes in politics, when you have a crisis comes up, how you handle that can define your future. And to your point, I think some of these local mayors have really stepped up to the plate and really shown leadership above and beyond what anybody would have expected for them when they got elected to that post. So, you know, it's hard to tell this early on what this crisis is going to portend for these electeds, and if they run for something else, if it kind of catapults them to something higher. But I do think a lot of the local officials have done a great job of keeping their communities informed, of working with their local agencies as well as the state to really try to keep their communities safe. And you know, I don't want to sound like a rip here, but this is just, it's something we've never seen before. And I don't think any person who ran for mayor of any city in Arizona, be it last year, 2 years, 4 years ago, whenever they first ran, had any idea they'd ever be dealing with something like this. No. So, you know, they're doing something that many of us would never have expected. And most of them are handling this with just the highest level of professionalism and doing a great job for their communities. And so more power to all of them, because they are in a very, very tough spot right now.
Marcus, this is another example of how we often hear polls that say, God, I love my mayor, love my council, but God, those people in Congress are just terrible, because we feel like we're right next to them on the ground. Whether they're doing a better job or not, it sure kind of seems like it.
Well, I think they're doing their job the best that they can. Okay. I'm not going to go. I think when you look, you know, specifically the mayors that we've cited, you know, all come from sort of deep Democrat roots. The story that's probably not being talked about is the fact that Senator Kyrsten Sinema was on the phone to all those mayors begging them to do that. Whether you agree or don't agree, you know, I think she's got a valid point to limit, you know, to get our social distancing up. But you can see how politics played in that sort of lobbying job, if you will. I will say this, and I think that Chad would agree, that this is a moment in time where we are going to see the best in leadership from our elected officials and some of the worst behavior from our elected officials. And I would tell people, if you are looking at your if there's elected officials out there that are doing making policy decisions based on what their future elected office will be or what their next campaign mailer would be, that, you know, those are the people that you probably don't want in elected office.
Chad, final word before the break. Go ahead.
No, I would agree with that. Exactly what Marcus said. You know, this is not a moment in time when you try to politicize something or try to promote a self-serving agenda. This is about moving the community forward as a whole and putting aside any petty politics.
Chad Campbell of Strategies 360, Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic. It is the newscap here on KJZZ, which continues after this. This is the Friday newscap on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, joined today by Chad Campbell of Strategies 360 and Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic. They're practicing social distancing, or at least they claim to be. gentlemen, let's go a little bit closer to home as far as the legislature approving a budget, taking a hiatus for now. Chad, as someone who served in the legislature, again, this is something we've never seen before. How weird does this feel to not have the legislature in session in late March?
I mean, it's strange, no doubt about it, but it's obviously the right thing to be doing, and it was necessary. And I think, you know, for the most part, the legislature kind of came together, both sides of the aisle, passed a budget that was appropriate, passed some emergency relief related to the COVID situation, and really did their business without getting into at least, I guess, I should say, highly polarizing partisan fights for the most part, as much as can be possible down there. And got out of there for the time being. And that was the right thing to do. You know, especially in the Senate, you saw that the Dems and Republicans come together in the Senate and really get the business done pretty quickly and in pretty short order. And that was refreshing to see. And I think you're seeing it even at the federal government a little bit, although we'll see how that goes today in the House in D.C., right? But it's nice to see some people put aside some of the partisanship and try to come together and work on solutions to this issue. Because as Marcus said earlier, the economic impact of this is going to be long and difficult. And we are just beginning to see the problems associated with that.
Marcus, it seems like the Capitol was in great use of a great need of some sort of power cleaning anyway. And this was kind of an excuse to clean that place up. But as far as what Chad is saying, obviously this needed to be done, but is there room to come back? And if things calm down, do you think there will be a need if, in fact, it is safe to go back?
I'm sorry, I lost you guys for a second. Was that for me?
Yeah, Marcus, in terms of like what happens, let's say if the legislature is able to come back, will there be things that will have to be accomplished at this point? This was an emergency contingency sort of budget. What do you make of what was actually passed? And would there be need to come back, let's say, if, in fact, it is possible to do it?
Well, let me start with your first question. You know, the budget that they passed was called, affectionately referred to as, a skinny budget.
All right.
You know, for the layman's terms, it was a budget based on last year's numbers, but not a deep dive budget by any stretch of the imagination. They're scheduled to come back April 13th, which, if you listen to Dr. Crist, who is the head of DHS and sort of the woman in charge of COVID in Arizona, she's saying our cases are going to hit an all-time, our high is going to come mid-April when these guys are supposed to go back into session. They're going to come back. The question is whether they come back April 14th. And I think that there's a lot of questions out there as that relates to it. But there will be a lot of work to do. And I think we are underestimating sort of the economic damage that is going on right now. Our unemployment figures are now surpassing our highs that we had in the 08 recession. So there's going to be a lot of, instead of, you know, a month ago, you would say the budget was going to be flush with cash. We're actually going to be cutting now.
Well, what comes down to the rainy day fund? Of course, the governor wanted $1 billion. That level was reached. Is this a rainy day? Are we going to see a rainy day in a month or two?
I think we will. To be honest with you, if you're comparing this to the 08 recession already, I think that we're going to be tapping into that at some point. I don't know if it'll be April. I don't know if it'll be May or June. But at some point, we'll probably be tapping into that.
Chad, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, it's an election year, and usually during election years, legislators tend to not want to be at the Capitol very, very long because they want to be out campaigning and trying to get reelected, right? I think that may not happen this year, though. They may have to keep coming back down there. I could see a scenario where the governor has to call a special session over the summer, maybe more than one special session, to deal with the ongoing impacts of the COVID situation, both from an economic perspective as well as the public health perspective. You know, nobody knows how this is going to play out on the public health side. Once we hit peak and once numbers start to go down because of the self-isolation and the social distancing and all that, nobody knows what happens when society starts ramping it back up. We're seeing in some parts of Asia now that some of the cities and areas that are kind of loosening restrictions are already seeing a rise in COVID again. So we don't know what's going to happen, and there could be multiple special sessions this summer and fall, depending on how this thing plays out. And you know, that's usually not what legislators want to see in an election year, but I think they're going to have to do it this year, depending on what happens over the next few months.
Marcus, does that sound likely to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that we have the potential to have a number of special sessions. I agree with Chad wholeheartedly on that one, because this is a fluid situation, and, you know, and again, something new that we haven't dealt with before. So we may need to come back, you know, one on budget, but two on public health concerns as this sort of thing works its way through the pipeline.
One other item when it comes to this, and obviously the skinny budget, Marcus, as you said, was passed. It's taken care of. But why did $50 million and $11.8 billion budget, why did it hold it up for a few days from the Senate to the House? Is that a reflection of the fact there are 60 bodies instead of 30? Anything behind the scenes you guys can enlighten us on there?
I would say that, you know, what happened essentially is that the Senate made some small changes. The House was not prepared for those changes, so that they needed to have that discussion. And that's why it added essentially one more day to the budget than really needed to be there. You know, and it sort of centered a little bit around this fight. I think everybody knows that Senator Boyer and Senator Carter have been fighting for firefighters and cancer presumption. That at the end of the day is a really expensive bill. And so that was sort of holding up the process. But, you know, I am thankful that they finally got out of there. Yeah. I think it was probably 3 days longer than it needed to be. But you cannot have 90 legislators all, you know, on top of each other and not expect at some point somebody's going to come down with this virus. So I'm glad they finally got out.
Yeah, Chad, brief follow-up on that without it being, you know, without nitpicking too much. Is this something that the House really would have been able to take up and not take the weekend off?
You know, hindsight's always 20/20, right? and, you know, spending 8 years down there as an elected, I know the difficulties of budget negotiations and passing a budget just in a normal environment, let alone an environment like this. So from what I gather, though, to Marcus's point, I think Marcus is spot on. And on top of that, I think there were some communication issues from what I could tell between the House leadership and the Senate leadership. And I think maybe, you know, the House felt that the Senate had done some things without consulting them. And it took a while to get those votes lined up and put everything in order in the House. And that's usually the case in a normal budget cycle. So when you're pushing something through at this rapid, accelerated pace, you're going to have probably even more communication breakdowns as it goes through. So in the grand scheme of things, they did a great job, actually, and really got it out of there pretty quickly, all things considered.
It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today remotely are Marcus DeLartino and Chad Campbell. Guys, one other thing I wanted to cover today is Politico's reporting
that Senator McConnell-related group has already plans to spend $9 million in Arizona, which really, I guess in the big picture, isn't that much in support of Senator McSally. Marcus, what do you make of that at this point? Is that going to turn into a lot more money pretty quickly? How early in the game will they be able to tell whether that is enough money for Martha McSally to match this, what we've heard, presidential-level fundraising of Mark Kelly?
I would say, let's affectionately call it the TV broadcasters bailout fund, because it's $9 million. I mean, that's a great thing that they've got going for them in this election cycle. You know, campaigns, and you are absolutely right about Mark Kelly. His fundraising numbers are astronomical, no pun intended, for the astronaut.
Yes,
but
yes.
But he's been doing great, and she definitely is behind in the fundraising, and that'll help. But we are in a whole new environment, and that comes to campaigns too. So, you know, I don't think there is going to be as much readily available money that we thought 60 days ago, where we thought that this state would be absolutely overcome with the highest amount of campaign spending in history. There's not going to be that much readily available money this campaign cycle because we're dealing with the current situation. So I think it'll be I certainly a big boost to Martha. There's no doubt about it. I don't think it's a surprise that was coming. But at the end of the day, you know, keep in mind that the campaigns and the targeting and everything that happens associated with it's going to be a lot different this election cycle.
Yeah, Chad, we know things are going to change dramatically. But hearing this, that there's already this plan for right around Labor Day, what does that tell you about this potential McSally-Kelly battle, which, of course, we've talked about a lot? We expect it to be a big one with a lot of money being spent.
Well, it shows again that I think the national Republicans know she's in jeopardy. It shows again that this Senate seat could actually determine who holds the majority in the U.S. Senate after this is all said and done. And, you know, to sit here and think that Arizona could have two Democratic senators this time next year was unheard of just a few years ago. And it shows you how rapidly this state is changing. But I think that ultimately, you know, when this is all said and done, we get to this COVID situation. I don't know if people are thinking about this in the same light anymore. And I think a lot of people, we've seen the polling, Kelly is pretty far up in most of the polling I see. His popularity is high, hers is not. She may have a lot of ground to make up with a group of people that just don't really care that much anymore. And so it may be more difficult for her now in some ways because of this, because I don't think people are sitting around thinking about the U.S. Senate race, at least average people, people like me and Marcus. They're not sitting around thinking about it like they used to. And a lot of people, excuse me, have a baked in opinion right now of her. I think they've seen her in the last election cycle. They've seen her this cycle. A lot of people aren't really fond of her in terms of politically. And I think she has a tougher road even now, because I don't think people are going to be dwelling on this and really thinking too much about this for the foreseeable future, at least.
And Marcus, clearly because of your Apollo 13 watching, you've had Mark Kelly on the brain, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, he's on my TV. I should say that, too. So there's no escape from him at this point. But, you know, I don't know how you guys feel, but I just saw an independent expenditure ad, you know, running this week for Martha McSally. And, you know, I understand that they feel the need to get up on air. It's not her campaign that's running the ads. Yeah. It's an independent expenditure group. But to some extent, I was sort of turned off by that. And remember, I'm a Republican, but I'm turned off by the fact that, you know, people are running political ads right now. And, you know, it gets to the heart of where I am on this. This isn't about being a Republican or a Democrat. This is about being an American right now and solving this problem and getting through it. So being bombarded by political ads right now, for me, is sort of a turnoff.
Yeah. Guys, final note as we go in the last few seconds. So many of us are, even those of us who are working, are still watching a lot of different things on. Marcus, you mentioned Apollo 13. What's the best thing you've seen since you've been at home in the last couple of weeks?
This is going to sound sappy, but my three girls.
Wow, that did sound sappy, but sweet.
I can't
time.
Even follow that up now. Yeah, that's a horrible answer.
Yeah, Chad,
me.
With
I'm
you, it's
going to
be
now.
Probably coffee or tea, something like that.
Well, I'll go back to the best TV show I'm watching.
Yes,
is
please.
I finally have been hooked on Succession. Got through season one of that show. Amazing show. Just in every way, shape, and form. It's an amazing show, so I'm hooked on that show now.
Marcus, we'll give you five more seconds to make up for this and not let us feel sappy. Favorite TV show you've seen?
Favorite TV show? Navy SEALs on CBS every Wednesday night. You TiVo it, right. And go back and watch season one.
Okay. Marcus Delartino of First Strategic, Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Guys, stay safe. Thanks for the time today.
Thanks, you. Guys. Miss you guys.
You too. Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, we'll hear about a unique group of people who are able to sing multiple sounds at the same time.
It's a very unusual way of producing sound. It's a way of producing usually two, almost a pure tone kind of sound from the human voice, which is very difficult to accomplish with the human voice.
We'll hear more about tube and throat singing just ahead on the show.
69 people on the Navajo Nation have tested positive for the coronavirus as of Wednesday night. Those without access to clean running water have become some of the most vulnerable to the highly contagious virus. That's just one of the issues facing the Navajo. Laurel Morales of KJZZ's Fronteras Desk joins me to discuss some of the other factors that may be confounding the problem. Hi, Laurel.
Good morning, Mark.
So what are some of the issues facing Navajos?
So 40% of people living on the Navajo Nation, that's as many as 140,000, haul water and use outhouses. And they live in what's known as a food desert. An area the size of West Virginia has only 9 grocery stores. I spoke to Shanna Yazzie in Cameron, who drives 50 miles round trip to go to the grocery, haul her drinking water and trash. And she says the grocery in Tuba City was out of fresh fruit, potatoes, and toilet paper. And many people just don't have the gas money to drive to the next town over to find another grocery store.
It's a lot tougher. It's more manual work, lots of vehicle usage to drive to a nearby town or into a local border town such as Flagstaff to obtain and search for drinking water.
It's important to look at the spread of H1N1 in 2009. American Indians and Alaska Natives died from H1N1 at 4 times the rates of all other racial and ethnic groups combined. That's according to a study by the National Institutes of Health.
Laurel, many people on the Navajo Nation are obviously isolated in rural areas. How have they been able to, for example, check in on elders living alone?
It's been really challenging. Over the weekend, the Navajo president ordered everyone to stay home. Former Navajo Nation Attorney General Ethel Branch started a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for Navajo and Hopi families, and she's raised more than $166,000. Now she's enlisting volunteers to deliver food to elders and immunocompromised people. And because unemployment rates are so high on the Navajo Nation, many people move off the reservation for work, leaving family members behind. I spoke to Emma Robbins, who moved to Los Angeles for her job. Her dad lives in Tuba City.
The fact that people have to travel so far is something that is really scary, because with gas or with even having a working vehicle, or if you're showing symptoms and you're too sick to drive, you know, it's not like an ambulance can get out there immediately. My dad in Tuba City said that the police officers are going around on the loudspeaker encouraging people to stay in their homes. But also saying that if you are showing symptoms and you need to go to the hospital, to call ahead beforehand so that they can have a plan to get you in separated from everybody else.
The Tuba City Hospital is telling many people to stay in their cars. They'll come out to your car and check vitals so you're not sitting around a waiting room spreading or catching the virus.
Has the tribe considered shutting down the reservation to outsiders?
Yes, President Nez has considered it. The Navajo Nation receives a lot of visitors. They're just east of the Grand Canyon, so there are Grand Canyon overlooks, and there are lots of places that tourists love to go to, Antelope Canyon, Canyon de Chelly. And President Nez has considered it, but their police department is just so short-staffed. They wouldn't have enough officers to keep communities safe if they also had police manning roadblocks.
So is there any sort of funding available to the tribe right now?
The Senate approved Wednesday night a relief package that provides $8 billion for tribes. Under that legislation, tribes will be eligible for business loans. The Indian Health Service will receive over $1 billion for treatment and prevention. The USDA's food distribution program will receive $100 million. And law enforcement, the Bureau of Indian Education and Housing Programs will also receive additional funding. The Navajo Council ordered $4 million sent to the Navajo Nation Department of Health and also requested $40 million in Medicaid funds from the New Mexico governor to assist healthcare facilities on the reservation. On top of that, the Navajo Housing Authority has said it will suspend eviction notices and waive rental and homeownership payments. And the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority will delay utility disconnections and also some fees.
All right. That is KJZZ's Laurel Morales from the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff. Laurel, thank you.
You're welcome, Mark.
VA healthcare workers may not have the protection they need, and there are questions about the care they can provide. So far, there are close to 500 VA patients nationwide with COVID-19. Filling in for Tanzina Vega on WNYC, here's Al Jazeera's Duarte Geraldino with Reveal's Aaron Glantz, whose recent reporting raises concerns about under-testing and badly managed protocols for avoiding contagion.
There's a lot of pressure on the Department of Veterans Affairs. In recent years, staffing and funding issues have plagued it, and it's still struggling to respond to high rates of suicide among veterans. Now, as COVID-19 spreads across the country, the VA is facing tough questions about how it's handling this crisis. Many healthcare VA workers say they're not getting the protection they need to keep themselves or veterans safe.
It's supposed to be the backstop for the civilian healthcare system during a moment of crisis. And what I'm hearing is that the VA is barely able to take care of itself right now. And in many ways, it's way behind where it should be.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He says the VA was already troubled before this pandemic, and that fact doesn't bode well for its healthcare workers and patients across the country.
The VA is entering this crisis short 44,000 frontline healthcare workers, thousands of doctors, over 10,000 nurse vacancies before this crisis started. So you're looking at the nation's largest integrated healthcare system that serves 9 million veterans annually. A majority of them are over the age of 65. Many of them have underlying health concerns related to war that make them especially vulnerable to the crisis. And the VA is dealing with this from the get-go, a little bit understaffed.
How have things changed since President Trump took office?
He has been emphasizing a move to private care at the VA and more quote-unquote choice for veterans. And many have said that this has led to neglect of the traditional integrated healthcare system. The VA is different from Medicare. Medicare is an insurance program. The VA is a hospital system. There are hospitals that are run by the government all around the country. And so one of the things that we're seeing across the country right now is that our system of private care is vulnerable to a pandemic because it is so diffuse and there's so many different parts of it to access and control. Well, the VA is a system that can be controlled, but it is entering this crisis understaffed in part because of neglect from the Trump administration.
Now, if you were to just base your view on the White House press briefings, you would think the system is doing incredibly well. But based on your reporting, what you have seen, how is it different?
The VA is saying that it has enough masks. There are adequate security protocols in place. They are saying that they have enough tests. And that is not at all what I'm hearing from frontline healthcare providers and veterans who are going in to use the VA. I talked to a frontline healthcare worker who had to drive 40 miles to get tested privately when she started to be sick with flu-like symptoms because there were not enough tests on hand at the VA. I talked to people that are frontline healthcare workers standing outside of the VA doing the screening, asking veterans who are showing up at their appointments questions to see if they have coronavirus, who were not equipped with masks until the union stepped in and provided them. I've talked to veterans who are walking into infusion drip wards to get regular IV treatments, surrounded by patients in chemotherapy, who said that none of the nurses were wearing masks. I've received emails directly, you know, obtained them from the VA, sent from supervisors to employees, telling people that even if they have been exposed to the coronavirus, that they should still come into work without being tested. And this is scaring the workers because they're worried that they could be spreading the disease amongst their elderly patients without even knowing that they had it.
Aaron Glantz is with us. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And as part of his reporting, he spoke with someone from a VA medical center in Wisconsin. A veteran tested positive there.
He presented at the clinic. And of course, at the moment he presented, they did not yet know that this patient was positive for COVID-19. Later, they learned that the patient was positive for COVID-19, and the supervisor informed the nursing staff there who treated this patient directly that they were to continue to come to work, even though two of those people actually were exhibiting flu-like symptoms themselves. And so those employees who interacted with this veteran with the help of their union, they called the Department of Workers' Comp. They put in a workman's comp complaint. The county, the local county, put them under quarantine for their own safety and for the safety that they were interacting with. But if they had not taken these outside steps, they could have very easily been out there the very next morning treating vulnerable patients, potentially exposing them to this pandemic.
So what's the protocol for staff at the VA who are feeling ill or who could have been exposed to the virus? What are they supposed to do?
Well, the VA is saying that they are following the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines say that if you have been exposed to a patient and you are not experiencing the symptoms of coronavirus, if you have a fever that is below 100.4, that you should continue to work. And this is really concerning staff because we know, you know, we keep getting this message out there in the public that if you've been exposed to the coronavirus in any way, that you should stay home. You know, Senator Rand Paul has been criticized because even after he got the test for COVID-19, after he got the test, but before he tested positive, he continued to go about his daily activities, potentially exposing other senators. Well, here we have our VA hospital staff dealing with people who are necessarily sick, many of whom are elderly, and the staff is saying that they're worried that they could be carriers of the virus. And in addition, they are reporting to me massive shortages of protective gear that makes them even more exposed to the patients who are presenting at their medical centers. So I'd say that the two biggest concerns are, one, that the staff at these hospitals, nurses, doctors, and others are literally putting their lives on the line each and every day, and they are terrified because they do not have adequate protective gear. And then second of all, they are worried that because they don't have protective gear and they are interacting with vulnerable patients, that they may indeed be spreading it amongst their patients. And so they are asking for, you know, more conservative protocols and more availability of testing. There seems to be very little, if any, testing available to VA staff that I can see, although the VA is telling me that they have adequate tests in place.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal, where he's been reporting on the VA's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Aaron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Duarte Geraldino with The Takeaway, and this is The Show. Good morning. It's The Show on KGAZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Okay, and now for something a little or maybe a lot different for the end of the show on this Friday morning, Tuvan throat singing. Researchers at the University of Arizona covered the secret to how this Central Asian practice is done. And if you've never heard it before, when you do, you'll understand why it was a mystery to begin with. These singers somehow make two different sounds at once. Here's more from Professor Brad Story with the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the U of A. He spoke with our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
The type of throat singing that we studied originates in the region of Tuva, which is right almost dead center in the middle of Asia. It's a very unusual way of producing sound in that it's a way of producing usually two, sometimes even one, almost a pure tone kind of sound from the human voice, which is very difficult to accomplish with the human voice based on the way that that our sound production system works. The type that we were looking at is called Hume, where you have a basic fundamental pitch, and then there's sort of a an enhancement of two to three what are called overtones.
So in this study, I want to back up for a second and talk about how you did this, because I think this is really interesting. So you're looking at, you know, how is it possible, essentially, that they can do this? How do they physically make this sound, two sounds at once kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And then you developed, I understand, a computer model to actually show how their throats work in this process, how they're doing it. How did you come up with that? How do you translate someone's, you know, vocal cords and the way that they're working into a computer model?
Right. So the computer model is really an area of research that I've been working on for most of my career. In fact, it's really based on simulating or, in effect, synthesizing speech. But the way that it works is that we're representing the shape of the throat and the mouth, and its coupling to the larynx as the sound source. Hmm. Within the sound source are the vocal folds that vibrate, and they provide this fundamental pitch that we all would lock into whenever you hear somebody speak or sing. And along with that pitch is all of these overtones that go along with it. And in typical speech, what we're doing is we're taking and shaping large groups of those overtones, increasing the energy in one group and suppressing in another. And that's what differentiates, say, an A vowel from an E vowel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what sounds like humans. And of course, with our computer simulation model, we're able to do a lot of interesting, really computer-like experimentation on how speech works.
Hmm.
So that was the baseline, is to start with exactly that same model and figure out what does this model need to do in order to replicate what the Tuvan singers are doing. And through a means of what we call optimization, we were able to really take our model of the throat and the mouth and deform it in many, many different ways until we figured out a control system that these singers might be using to be able to enhance the overtones in this unique way that they do in Tuvan singing.
So when we're speaking normally or singing normally, we're only producing one sound. They are able to do this essentially through operating entirely differently within their own vocal cords. How do they learn it?
Well, you know, they have a long history of teaching people, you know, how to do create these types of sounds. But I mean, one way that many people could get started in the right direction is to begin with an R sound, the R kind of sound. If you really create an extreme R type sound, it begins to do that. And so what you do with an R is that, as I said before, with a vowel sound, we're trying to enhance different groupings of overtones. And we do that with, I'm going to get into technical jargon a little bit, but the airspace itself, the throat and the mouth, the way in which they create the vowels is that the particular shape of that airspace creates what are called resonances. And those resonances are exactly what allows us to move energy around in these different groupings of overtones. What the Tuvan singers are doing is they're of those resonances, and they're forcing them together to be tight together at exactly the same pitch.
Hmm.
And what that does is that they build on top of each other. It's kind of like building sharp peak in a tent.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like having two tents that come together, and you have a tent that's twice as high as the original tent.
So this is what you mean when you say that they're using their throats like musical instruments.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I want to ask you a little bit about how you got into this field of study, because this is a very specific thing to look at and to figure out how to do.
Sure. Well, my degree a long time ago, my bachelor's degree was in physics, and I took a job in an industry that built mufflers for over-the-highway trucks and large construction equipment and so on. And that's really where I learned a lot of acoustics. But we were building computer models of exhaust systems. And an exhaust system is really acoustically and physically not a whole lot different than the human vocal tract. And the reason I say that is that what we're looking at is really how waves, acoustic waves, propagate or travel through complicated spaces.
Sure. So that's what you're doing when you're creating mufflers.
Exactly. It's exactly the same thing. It's
that's
just,
so interesting.
You know, you have obviously the size of the system is very different and the temperature, the operating temperature is quite different. But all of the physics are really the same.
So what's next? I mean, this is a very specific study on, you know, these specific singers. What other applications are there for the work that you do for this model that you've created?
Well, most of what we do with these models is actually to study speech production. A computer model of speech production allows us to do a lot of virtual experiments of the type that we really can't do with human beings, because the speech production system itself, of course, it's part of our lifeline. It's our part of our respiration system, and so we can't put a lot of instrumentation inside the system to determine what's going on. And so the models allow us to create a lot of what if games of as to how things might work, and then we can compare that to say audio recordings of speech, of which there are plenty, and those are easy to come by. But the models also allow us to impose impairments that we hypothesize to be part of certain kinds of speech disorders, and understand the effect of that.
All right. Lots to come, I'm sure, then. That is Brad Story, a professor in the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the University of Arizona. Brad, thank you so much for coming on to tell us about this.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you can see videos of the Tuvan singers on our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.